You're listening to the CyberWire Network, powered by N2K.
And now a word from our sponsor, Netskope. Netskope is a worldwide leader in SASE and Zero Trust. Its unified platform, Netskope One, provides optimized access and Zero Trust security for people, devices, and data anywhere they go, helping customers reduce risk, accelerate performance, and get unrivaled visibility into any cloud, web, and private application activity. To learn more about how Netskope helps customers be ready for anything on their SASE journey, visit netskope.com.
Hi, and welcome to Spycast. From the secret files of the International Spy Museum in Washington, D.C., I'm Dr. Vince Houghton, the museum's historian and curator. Every week, the museum brings you interesting conversations with authors, scholars, and practitioners who live in the world of global espionage. Join us as we take a closer look at the secret world of intelligence. We'd like to thank our wonderful sponsors, Harry's, Bloom That, and Sherry's Berries, for helping to make SpyCast possible. You'll hear more about these great companies later, but first, let's meet our guests. So we're joined today by Eva Dillon, who spent 25 years in the magazine publishing business in New York City, including stints at Vogue, Harper's Bazaar, Glamour, The New Yorker, and as president of Reader's Digest US. She and her six siblings grew up moving around the world for her father's CIA assignments in Berlin, Mexico City, Rome, and New Delhi. She is the author of Spies in the Family, An American Spy Master, His Russian Crown Jewel, and The Friendship That Helped End the Cold War. And that book literally comes out today, if you're listening to this, the day we posted it. A new book, fascinating firsthand account of one of the most extraordinary espionage stories of the Cold War. So welcome, Eva. Thank you for taking the time to talk to us here at SpyCast.
Thank you.
So I want to start with a lot of authors. Sometimes it's kind of difficult to lock down what inspired them to write their book, you know, whether it's their research or some kind of time in the archives led them to a story no one had ever heard. Your inspiration comes from a slightly different source.
It does, actually, a more familial source, in a sense. When I discovered the relationship my father had with the Cold War's highest ranking, longest serving Soviet asset, I wanted primarily to honor General Polyakov and his service to our country, the man that my father handled for so many years. You know, he was unique among agents who worked in the United States in that he didn't ask for money or asylum. Rather, he was really motivated to do what he could to lessen the era's very real threat of nuclear war by helping the Americans better interpret the Soviet leadership's thinking and intentions. But more tactically and, frankly, more emotionally motivating factor for me was when I learned that Polyakov's son had immigrated to the United States and was willing to share his story with me. And exclusively gaining access to his memories of his father and account of growing up unknowingly as a family of a spy and comparing that experience with my own inspired me to tell an incredible and fascinating Cold War story, but through the intimate and personal lens of the two families. And that's really how I think my book is different from so many of the, you know, Cold War spy books that I read. I had always wanted to know, yeah, but what went on behind the scenes with the families? And that's really was a large motivating factor for me with this story.
Yeah, I mean, you found a kindred spirit in somebody that may not have anything in common with you other than the fact that your fathers worked very closely together in intelligence during the Cold War.
Exactly. You know, and then what they had in common, like you said, was our fathers. Like when I first met him, it was an emotional reunion because, you know, knowing what his father and my father had been through was a very strong bond between the two of us. We both felt it.
Let me ask you about sources. Because anytime anyone writes a book on intelligence, they can be problematic. In this case, it's not all that easy. Many have died, including somewhat both main characters, both of your fathers. And also, you know, a lot of what was given to us during that time is still not necessarily obsolete. So there's still a lot of, I'm sure you ran into this when in the archives, lots and lots of things that are redacted. So how did you go about finding sources to make this book worthwhile?
Well, you know, most books like this one about Cold War spies, for instance, are written by journalists or historians, and they write books when they gain access to new troves of information, preferably newly declassified, like as you were saying. But Polyakov's case remains classified and probably will for years. I came at it quite differently. As I conducted my research, I found that there was actually quite a lot of information available on Polyakov open source, but it was scattered. No one had ever collected it in one place, and I spent years hunting it down, including various media from Russia and the Soviet Union, the former Soviet Union. Of course, though, my most cherished and crucial sources were my interviews with more than 18 of my father's former colleagues and friends. And as you had mentioned, a number of them had passed on. Crucial people had passed on. So I really needed to, you know, find as many as I could. And interviews with the FBI and most critically and extensively with Alexander Polyakov and his family. Eventually, I found myself with a mountain of material on Polyakov, but I didn't want to write the book that a journalist or a historian would and should write someday. I wanted to write a book by a daughter with the help of a son and all of its newsworthy and human ways. I really wanted to capture the human interest part of this story, how geopolitical events between governments affect real people in profound ways.
And I think that's really what sets this book apart, is that you are kind of giving the reader an entry point as almost a fly on the wall in some of these kind of real world interactions. I mean, you don't tend to see that in the movies. You don't tend to see that in a lot of books, kind of the family struggles and some of the really insider knowledge of how people are really thinking during this time.
Exactly. Exactly. That was certainly for me one of the more both joyous and also heart-wrenching aspects of writing this book, because both families went, of course, through some wonderful times moving around the world and experiencing cultures, but certainly in the case of Polyakov and his family, it was very heart-wrenching. But I think it was just something that needed to be done. The story needed to be told. You know, the version of Polyakov as a hero was a huge motivation for me. Of course, in his own country, he's the opposite. He's considered a traitor. But to us, you know, he served our country for 18 years, and his family suffered for that. And I really was motivated in a way to write this book as a gift to the Polyakovs.
Well, let's talk about him for kind of take a step back and let the listener in on who this man was. I mean, this is somebody who came out of the Second World War as a war hero, from a very, you know, martial family of war heroes. And he really gets his first taste of the United States. That should sound familiar to anybody watching the Americans or anything. He's sent by the GRU, Russian or Soviet military intelligence, to run the illegals program here in the United States.
Exactly. And it is, like you mentioned, the Americans. When I tell people that at dinner parties, you know, they're like, oh, you know, did he run around and do jujitsu and stuff dead bodies into car trunks? I'm like, no, it's not what they did. You know, they had a very serious mission of stealing, military information and passing it back through Polyakov and back to Moscow Center. But, you know, Polyakov, yes, you said he was a war hero. He was commissioned into the army 1 week before Operation Barbarossa launched and was thrown up into the front and was badly wounded but recovered and served out the rest of the war and came home a hero. And then he was accepted into the very prestigious Frunze Military Academy and then into the GRU and sent to the United States in 1951 under cover of the Soviet mission to the UN Delegation Military Staff Committee. And that, of course, was his cover, and his real job was running the illegals. But, you know, Polyakov was really the rarest of agents. You know, the reason he lasted for as long as he did, 18 years, you know, most people flame out because, most people who become agents, and not all, there are certainly many other exceptions, but most do lack some sort of something in their character. You know, they're doing it for money. They're doing it for revenge. They spend too much money and they become, you know, a target and they flame out. But in the case of Polyakov, he was careful. He was composed. He did not ask for money and therefore did not flaunt any wealth. You know, he was not a drunk or a womanizer. And he was really true to his heart and his soul when it came to his ideology. And this combination is rare in an officer.
Yeah,
and,
But you've already hinted at his motivation several times, but I think you even said that he's considered a traitor in Russia by the Soviet Union. But his real motivation was actually to save the Soviet Union. I mean, he was not somebody who wanted to defect. He wasn't somebody that wanted to screw up his country. He just really had a harsh distaste for the leadership there, especially Nikita Khrushchev.
Absolutely. I mean, his motivations were interesting and complex. You know, so as I said, you know, he was in the World War II, and he survived that and came home as a hero. But at some point after the war, it is believed that he began to view the Soviet leaders as corrupt thugs, you know, mocking the sacrifices that the American people had made during the war. And then Khrushchev dismissed General Georgi Zhukov, whom Polyakov considered to be the greatest Russian general of the war. The military adored Zhukov, no one more than Polyakov, who considered the firing an unforgivable insult to him and every veteran of the Great Patriotic War. And Polyakov disliked Khrushchev with a passion. You know, he considered him an uncouth boor, prone to emotional outbursts like the infamous, you know, we're turning out missiles like sausages
line,
which deeply embarrassed him. And then to add insult to injury, Polyakov was in the UN General Assembly in 1960 when Khrushchev famously hit his desk with his shoe. And eventually, Polyakov just felt that Khrushchev threatened the uneasy peace between the superpowers and wanted to help Americans better interpret Soviet leaders' thinking and motivations in a quest to avoid nuclear war. You know, he really was very pure ideologically.
There's an interesting anecdote in the book about how Polyakov met with an American general with the instructions of actually finding out what would be the response to any kind of Soviet move on Berlin. And it sounds as though, of course, there's no way to prove this, that he could have been the impetus for the building of the Berlin Wall somewhat tangentially.
Yes. Well, that whole story starts with the fact that, Polyakov's, beliefs are starting to change, and he wants to volunteer his services to, you know, our country. And he asked a fellow military mission, somebody in the military staff, the American counterpart in the UN mission, to introduce him to General Edward O'Neill, who is the leading, the commander of the American First Army at Fort Jay on Governor's Island, and also on the mission. And Paul Fahey, by this time, had become an informant for the FBI, telling him everything that Polyakov was doing. And Paul Fahey went to Ed Moody, the FBI agent who was in charge of Polyakov, and said, "Huh, you know, he's asked for this meeting to talk with General Edward O'Neill." So they set up a whole party and invited Polyakov and his wife, and ran some wires down to the basement and recorded the conversation between Polyakov and General O'Neill. And the book actually features the first ever transcript of this tape. It has never been published or heard before, of him offering to, saying that he wanted to offer his services to the CIA. After he made that offer, he also said, "By the way, what would happen if we invaded Berlin?" And this was on August 9th, the evening of this cocktail party. And he said, "What would happen if we invaded Berlin?" And General O'Neill said, "War, all out war. It's totally clear." And Ed Moody, the FBI agent, rushed that information down to the White House and the FBI. And 4 days later, they started building the wall. Now, I'm sure there were many, many factors and reasons for the building of the wall, and it wouldn't all have been because of what Polyakov asked. But Moody does believe that, you know, they were testing. They were trying to find out many answers. And was that one of them? We don't know, but it could be very possible.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of Cold War historians point to the building of the wall as kind of an agreement on both sides that the territories were not going to change, that the borders were going to stay the same, And you can see how this last-ditch effort to see what the Americans would say if the Soviets moved on Berlin was a final, all right, you know what, let's just lock down our position right now and build a wall. It's impossible to prove, but it certainly makes a lot of sense if you think about the timing of this conversation.
Absolutely.
We'll hear more from Eva in a second, but Mother's Day is this Sunday. And we're going to be inundated with ads on podcasts, on TV, radio, everywhere, including here. But there's something you need to know about many of the flower companies advertising today. They cut corners. There's hidden fees and surcharges. You might think there's a $30 deal, but if all the stuff they tack on, it turns into a $60 ripoff. Plus, what you see isn't what you get. Sometimes, because of Mother's Day and there's a rush for roses, they might even run out of roses and they'll substitute carnations or other flowers that not what you ordered. The biggest issue is they're old flowers that are picked weeks ago. They bring them in from other countries, from other continents. By the time they get to you, they've been around forever. Many of the times they never open, or they open but die right away. And they just kind of shove them in a box. The arrangement comes from a warehouse. Look, Mother's Day is incredibly busy. There's a lot of people making orders, so they get essentially an assembly line of people just kind of sticking flowers in a box. It's not done by a designer. It's done by somebody making minimum wage. Your mom is going to say that she loved your gift no matter how bad and sad and pathetic it might be. But don't make your mom lie and say she loved your flowers. Use Bloom That, the flower company that doesn't cut corners. Bloom That flowers are handcrafted. They're arranged by a designer, not by just some minimum wage guy. They're beautiful flowers she would buy for herself. They're fresh. They're picked right before you order, so they last forever. They're not being shipped from another continent. They're being picked right near where the Bloom That headquarters is. And so why Bloom That? Well, each bouquet is designed and handcrafted, and what you see is exactly what you get. And it comes with an elegant burlap wrap to make an amazing first impression. Here we're talking boutique quality bouquet, but value price. Now, look, I've ordered a lot of flowers in my day, a combination of trying to be nice. You know, I've been married almost 11 years. My mom still around. A lot of times trying to be nice. Other times, I've been need to make up for doing something stupid. But either way, I know what flowers look like when you order them online. And I can tell you that I immediately noticed the difference between what I used before and Bloom That. These are gorgeous. They're obviously fresh flowers and beautiful packaging. So here's how to get this for your mom, or maybe even for yourself, because Bloom That is offering a great deal. The best price on gorgeous bouquet, just picked, hand-designed, Instagram-ready, plus a premium designer vase that costs everyone else about $15, plus handmade caramel treats, normally $10, but also free for our listeners. That's a huge savings, about $25, and it's the best deal they're offering. But you only get this deal if you go to our page, bloomthat.com/spycast. That's bloomthat.com/spycast, and find the perfect handcrafted designer flowers. You'll automatically get the free premium designer vase and caramel treats, a $25 value. Mother's Day is this week. Take 2 minutes and really blow her away. Again, it's bloomthat.com/spycast for premium design bouquet, free vase, and treats. Don't wait. This amazing offer won't last, and it's only available to our listeners if you go to bloomthat.com/spycast. Let's just take another step back and shift to the other main character of this book, which is your father, Paul Dillon. He is a career CIA officer. He started working with refugees right after the war with the idea of sending them back in into the Soviet Union and try to be eyes and ears on the ground. What I thought was interesting for people out there that may not know, this wasn't just grab people and send them back in. There was full training involved. In areas they would expected to know, right? The idea is if you're going in and pretending that you're a soldier who just got out of the war and you're in a certain army unit and you're from a certain area, just like if you're pretending you're a New Yorker, you better know who starts at first base for the Yankees. You better know who your commander was in your army unit. These are things that they had to learn and be trained to understand.
Absolutely. You know, they very carefully vetted the refugees that came into, you know, out of the Soviet Union, the Soviet bloc, and into these refugee centers to find people who would be qualified and be willing to go do something as dangerous as being, you know, dropped back into their own country as a spy, especially given the era and what was going on. And my father, that was his first CIA job, actually. You know, he had just been trained himself in a lot of these tactics of surveillance and you know, combat and whatnot. And so he would take on teams of these refugees and train them. And they were very intense training times. You know, they trained together for 3 months. They practiced parachute jumping from an old Nazi Air Force hangar in Kaufbeuren, which was about a half an hour away from where my parents were living in Kempten near Munich. And they trained them in all kinds of you know, information for you know, evasion, escape, you know, all the various ways that they could be good you know, informants once they were dropped back in. And so the issue, though, was that my father would train these teams and then would send them off and send them off with radios and packs and information and with instructions to send back a Morse code to inform them that they had landed safely and everything was going well. Only one after another were launched and never heard from. And this had to have been extremely stressful for my father and the other, you know, officers who were doing the same kind of training. And, you know, months went by and they would send off more and more of these teams. And, you know, they never did know why until finally it became clear years later Kim Philby, the infamous British spy who had been working for the Soviets for over 15 years at that point, you know, had actually been working closely with James Angleton, who was the CIA counterintelligence chief, and they were working together on these programs, sending their own teams back behind the Soviet curtain, usually, you know, by being parachuted in. And Angleton was giving all the parachute coordinates and places of drops and whatnot to Kim Philby, who just as quickly was giving them then to the KGB. And it turned out that every single one of my father's teams were shot on the spot as soon as they were dropped. And, that is the true cost, the human cost of a Cold War, you know, what agents go through. We may not be in open warfare, but certainly there are very serious human costs, and that was what was happening there with the program. It was called Red Sox.
You know, according to Phil, because of Philby, at least 50 teams were compromised, just
yes.
one after
yes.
the other sent in.
Yes.
And a lot of people don't, again, think about that. They're like, oh, Philby gave him some secrets. He wasn't a very good guy. But, you know, no Americans died. But, you know, we're talking dozens and dozens and dozens of people who are willing to work for us were killed
Absolutely.
Because of that. Yeah. A couple years ago, a very interesting book came out about a book about a book, Dr. Zhivago, which was used by CIA as a very ingenious psychological operation mission against the Soviets during the war, essentially smuggling in Russian language copies of that book after it was banned in the Soviet Union. And your father was intimately involved in this.
Yes, absolutely. That was a great book, by the way. And yes, what I did find out in my research, and it started with me looking through family pictures and seeing a picture of my father in a suit and tie standing in front of the Soviet pavilion at the Brussels World Fair in 1958, and that was the first World Fair since World War II. And I was curious about, you know, what was Dad doing there in a suit? That looked like working to me, not as, you know, a vacation, because they would obviously go around on vacations all over Europe. And I asked around, and somebody said, oh, your father, surely what he was doing there was, you know, as you said, you know, he was sent to Brussels to hand out copies of Boris Pasternak's Dr. Zhivago. It had been banned in Russia for its individualistic tone and criticism of Stalinism and collectivism and the Great Purge. And the CIA picked up on Dr. Zhivago's potential in the ideological war against the Soviets. And so my father would give, they were giving them out to the fair goers. 14,000 of them were coming in from the Soviet Union. And the idea was to hand out these Russian versions of the book and let them smuggle them back into the Soviet Union so that citizens could read work of one of their own literary masters that reflected the truth about their lives under communist oppression. So that was kind of cool finding out that's what my dad was doing there in that picture.
Yeah, absolutely. And it sounds like your father worked for several years in Berlin recruiting agents before the wall went up. There's an interesting story also in the book about how your father was actually told from one of his assets about the wall going up in advance. And this was poo-pooed by a man you already mentioned that we'll talk a lot more about later.
Yes.
And that's Angleton, who had a, I mean, the CIA had an opportunity to find out about the wall going up in advance, but it was, you know, shut down before it got to high levels by Angleton.
I think the CIA had an opportunity to learn an awful lot about what was going on with the Soviet Union, but it was shut down by Angleton. And indeed, this was one small example of that, where, you know, just a few weeks before the wall went up, a defector coming through was debriefed by my father and a couple of other people on the team. They said, you know, I've got the plan, and it's that they're going to build this big wall. And that information went back to Langley, to James Angleton, the CIA counterintelligence chief, and he, you know, has a belief that all Soviet, all Soviets that are coming over with information are plants or provocations, and nothing is to be believed. And he waved them off. He said, "Let the guy go. We don't want to hear his story." And 2 weeks later, the wall goes up. You know,
right.
And I think a lot of the case officers who were there at the time. I mean, Berlin was one of the biggest CIA bases in the world at that time, given the activity that was going on there. And they had 180 case officers, and one of the other case officers that I interviewed said, "Oh my God, you know, when the wall went up, we were like, oh my God, there are 180 of us here, and none of us knew the wall was going up. We're all going to get fired because 180 case officers didn't know about the wall going up." You know, so yeah, it was unfortunate that some of these internecine wars, you know, would you know, block very, very crucial information that could have been very helpful. And that problem of, you know, the belief that all Soviet defectors were plants and provocations was, you know, strung out across a good 10 years, hampering the CIA.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to do this a little bit later, but let's talk Angleton a little bit, because this is a good time to kind of segue into that. There's a lot of reasons that he kind of goes off the deep end, and Philby, as you've already mentioned, is a big one of them. But there was also another Soviet defector, let's put quotes around that, Golitsyn, who turns out to be really the worst case scenario for somebody like Angleton, who's already thinking that direction.
Absolutely. Golitsyn knocks on the door of the CIA station manager in Helsinki and asks for asylum, and he comes over in 1961. And he comes over with tales of the KGB's superhuman effectiveness at deceiving Americans across the board. You know, that every you know, defector after him is part of a great big, you know, plot. And this claim struck perfectly with Angleton's ever more paranoid psyche. You know, when Angleton learned that his best friend, Kim Philby, who he had bonded with and shared and learned so much, had been a spy, he just started believing that everybody else could be. And here comes Golitsyn saying, you know, in fact, yes, there's this great big huge spy plot, and it's aimed at America, and it's happening all around you. And Angleton's obsessions resulted in attacks on the bona fides of all the post-Golitsyn Soviet defectors and sources. And the harm that this did to American efforts to understand and counter Soviet powers was really incalculable.
Yeah, it was a disaster for U.S. national security.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And somehow your father's actually able to avoid a lot of this, where other people in the Great Mole Hunt, kind of their careers went down in flames because Angleton kind of set his sights on them. Your father, fortunately, was able to kind of bounce around to places where maybe Angleton didn't have his sights set.
Yeah, you know, I think that if you were out of the country, he wasn't as close to being able to analyze you. I think other people who worked, you know, at headquarters more, you know, got the rat of his suspicions a bit more, you know. So my father would sort of pack up the family and accept any and all offers to get out of town, And I think it really helped because, you know, he could have been someone they might have targeted because he spoke fluent Russian and he was in the Soviet division and he handled lots of Soviet defectors. But for some reason, he was lucky. You know, it might have been that, you know, he was very Catholic and apparently the nickname around the office for him among people who knew him was Father Paul. And I don't know if, you know, if there was sort of this halo around him that made someone like Angleton not want to believe that he could possibly be the mole. But yes, he was very lucky, and we were out of town a lot. You know, we were in other postings.
Right. Let's walk back a little bit and talk a little bit more about Polyakov pre-CIA, before your father gets involved. Because when he first reaches out to the United States, he wants to work with CIA, but at the time, he's in the United States. And so the organization that takes him on at first is not the agency, it's actually the FBI.
Yes, yes. Well, when he went to General O'Neill saying that he wanted to volunteer, he specifically asked to volunteer with the CIA. And they said, okay, let us look into that. So, but of course, you know, intelligence jurisdiction in the United States is the FBI's, it's not the CIA's. But they do not open up to him and say, okay, actually, we're sending you an FBI guy. They pretend, and they send in a CIA guy or an FBI guy pretending to be a CIA guy, which is really pretty funny.
Yeah.
I personally believe Polyakov probably knew it all along because he was a very smart and intuitive person. But they did continue to play that ruse. They sent John Mabee, and John Mabee shows up at the second party being held at General O'Neill's house on Governor's Island, and they agree to meet later on that evening at Columbus Circle in New York. And there they meet, and John Mabee says, I need to have proof of your bona fides. I need the names of your cryptographers. And Polyakov knows that's, you know, he's an astute intelligence person himself, and he knows that's what he needs. And they meet again a week later at Grant's tomb and hands over the names of the cryptographers. And the FBI is just elated. They're over the top because they've never really had a real penetration of, you know, the GRU before. And a high-level one at this one, because at this point he was a colonel, you know, with access to all kinds of, you know, classified and secret material, and the knowledge of all of the illegals right. on the East Coast, which he does then hand over to them, you know, all the names of all the illegals. But they do make an agreement not to roll them up all at once, because then it'll be obvious that they have a somebody inside working on it. So they didn't roll them all up.
The FBI already knew the names of the cryptographers. This wasn't something that they were trying to get new information about. But in essence, this is a test to see if Polyakov is above board, because if he wasn't, it was just a dangle trying to get people in trouble. There's no way he would have handed over the names of the real names of the cryptographers.
And that's exactly right. And when he came back with the real names of the cryptographers, the FBI was over the moon, celebrating, backslapping, goes all the way up to J. Edgar Hoover, because they knew he was real. And, you know, he would not have handed over the real names. Those are some of the most closely held information that any residentura wants to keep, is the cryptographers. And so it was a huge, and a very exciting, showing that he really, really was the real deal and was willing to, and was not a dangle.
Well, other than passing on information about all the illegals on the East Coast and a lot of tradecraft information, things like secret inks and codes and organizational structure, one thing I thought was really kind of funny, probably not funny for the FBI at all, but Polyakov told them that the GRU and the KGB were fully monitoring FBI communications, had totally, nothing the FBI ever did was not completely monitored by Soviet intelligence.
Yes, absolutely. And they were completely shocked, which was shocking to me, because you would have thought by then they would have been on top of any kind of communications and radio activity that was going on there. But in fact, the KGB had figured out how to monitor the radio airwaves of all the FBI and was listening to everything, all their chatter going back and forth. And so the FBI, they were always very impressed with how Polyakov could sort of outmaneuver them. You know, obviously they were tailing him everywhere he went, and he had this blue Ford Fairlane, and they would follow him around, but he'd be able to sort of get through the light or get away, and they could never quite figure out how he always seemed to know. And then eventually, once Polyakov started working with the FBI, he told them, you know, that you know, we've been listening to you forever, you know, for the longest time. And I think they were very embarrassed, and they changed all of their, you know, operational approaches to everything. And as a result, you know, a lot of stuff changed for that reason. But I thought it was funny that they didn't know about it in the first place.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of these things that you look at, and maybe it permanently changed the way the FBI did counterintelligence, just having that knowledge about how effective the Soviets were at getting around the FBI had to have been a game changer. I can imagine Hoover was not all that happy to hear stuff like that.
No, I'm sure Hoover wasn't. And then they had to reduce themselves to tricks in order to stay on top of Polyakov. You know, he'd slip away in his car and they'd lose him. And Ed Moody, the FBI agent who followed him for the longest period of time for during his two tours to New York, would, when given the opportunity, he would drop a rolled up condom into the gas tank, and within a few minutes it would float down into the feed line and stall the car, and they could catch up. And of course they delighted in, you know, traumatizing Polyakov, and they would break his taillight so they could see him at night and whatnot. And he eventually complained to the UN security people and said, "Hey, I am officially a diplomat, you know, and these people are hassling me." And he actually got them, you know, he got someone to come back to the FBI and say, "Stop hassling him so much." Yeah.
Let me pause for a quick minute to tell you more about Harry's. For decades, one big razor company has relentlessly increased prices and reaped immense profits at the expense of its customers. So Jeff and Andy, two ordinary guys who are fed up with getting ripped off, started Harry's to fix shaving. Harry's knew there was only one way to ensure quality. They bought their own blade factory. By taking less profit and selling directly to you over the internet, Harry's offers their blades at half the price, talking just $2 a blade compared to the $4 or more you'll pay at the drugstore. Look, everyone tells you they have the best products. And you get inundated with ads across all mediums saying this product or that product is the best. You, the listener, are probably a lot like me. You're smart, you're educated, refined, you're ravishingly good-looking. Did I miss anything, right? We don't fall for silly ads promising things that just aren't true. That's why I want to tell you more about how Harry's manufactures their razors. And this is what I find absolutely the coolest thing about them. They bought a German factory, which means they own the entire process from grinding high-grade steel to sending razors to your door. That means they can continue to innovate to make your shave even better. Their team in Germany has been grinding high-grade steel into some of the world's sharpest blades since 1920. Today, more than 400 German engineers, designers, craftsmen, and production workers build and operate sophisticated custom equipment that produces millions of precision blades every year. What this means is for you is that their blades will get even better. Your shave will get even better. They'll listen to your feedback of what makes a great shave and use their expertise to develop products that deliver you that experience. So now you can try Harry's for free. Harry's is so confident you'll love their blades, they're giving you their trial set for free. All you have to do is cover the $3 shipping. Your trial set will include a weighted ergonomic razor handle, 5 precision engineered blades with lubricating strip and trimmer blade, rich lathering shave gel, and a traveling blade cover. That's a $13 value for you to try. So stop messing around and get started shaving with Harry's today by claiming your free trial offer, $13 value for free, just cover shipping. To get this free trial set, including a razor handle, 5 blade cartridges, and shave gel, go to harrys.com/spycast right now. That's harrys.com/spycast. So in almost a perfect scenario, Polyakov is actually deployed back to Moscow, which gives the U.S., in this case the FBI and the CIA, an agent in place inside a denied area.
Yes.
But because they moved back to Moscow, the FBI couldn't run him alone anymore, and this is where the CIA has to get brought into the story.
Yes, exactly. So they have to go to the CIA and say, we need your help on this. And it was one of the first times that they ever did anything joint, because they've never had a shared agent before. And so they worked together with the CIA to put together the communication plans and the dead drop sites and the pickup sites for anything, the signal and dead drop sites in Moscow. But the FBI would still create and place the messaging. So one of the ways they did that, and they worked this out with Polyakov before he left, was to put messages into the New York Times personal ad section. And there would be, and they would be placed by Moody. So the drop sites would be men's names, Art, Bob, Charles. The signal sites were women's names, Betty, Clara. And the New York Times required that Ed Moody's full name and address appear on the ad. So even the FBI engaged in a high-risk clandestine operation had to bow to the rules of the New York Times, which is very funny. And they would run these ads for multiple days in case, in case the office didn't get the paper on a given day. And the New York ad editor started getting suspicious about, what are all these ads that are running for 10 days? And he called Moody down to his office and said, what's going on here? And Moody shows him his ID and says, well, actually, it's an FBI operation. And the editor is like, yeah. And he says, you can call my boss if you like. And he did call the boss. And only then did they allow him to continue to run the ad. So again, the New York Times always very careful about their sources. And that's how they communicated. And one of the first dead drops that Polyakov made in Moscow in 1962, when he had returned from New York, was in a subway system on a subway bench in a Band-Aid that had a microfilm piece. And he with his hand, he just kind of stuck it to the bottom of the bench. And the CIA was, told ahead of time that that's where it was going to be. So he left his signals drop and they picked it up. And it was a huge bonanza, especially for the FBI, because it revealed five major spies working in the U.S. That the FBI could pick up. Jack Dunlap, who was an Army sergeant, William Whalen, a Pentagon staff officer, Nelson Drummond, a Navy clerk, Herbert Bockenhaupt in the Air Force, and also a British officer with the British Ministry of Aviation, Frank Bossard, who had sent pictures to the GRU, and then Polyakov took pictures of his pictures and sent them back, and as a result, they were able to identify him. So it was a huge, find for them, of people who were informing, on the Americans to the Soviets.
Because it doesn't get any better. I mean, Polyakov is assigned to the American division back at GRU in Moscow. Essentially, he's ahead of assigned to the division that runs all these spies inside the United States.
Exactly.
It didn't take long, though. This is a time period, you talk about 1962, where a very prominent Soviet spy, or a spy who was Soviet officer spying for the United States and the British, was rounded up and arrested and then executed. And this is, of course, Oleg Penkovsky in the response to the Cuban Missile Crisis. That had to not feel good if you're Polyakov at this point.
Oh, my God. I mean, that was huge. He obviously, was very moved by that and very careful by that. And he had always told both his FBI and his CIA handlers, if for some reason I go dark, don't come looking for me, don't hassle me, don't send me, it's very dangerous, I'll be back in touch with you. And so after Oleg Penkovsky, who of course was the agent who gave most of the information to the Kennedy administration during the Cuban Missile Crisis, he was caught and executed. So Polyakov went dark. And the intelligence agencies never want their agents to be dark.
Right.
You know, they want the information. They wanted to keep talking. So Moody was, told to keep sending the various New York Times ads. And he would send ad after ad after ad, and Polyakov would just ignore them. But eventually, Polyakov did leave a signal and filled a drop in Gorky Park. And left his signal and then waited to, you know, get confirmation that the drop had been picked up. But he didn't get confirmation, and he didn't get it, and he didn't get it, and he didn't get it, and he didn't get it for 8 weeks, which, of course, as you can imagine, had to have been extremely stressful and worrisome to Polyakov, because what that could have meant, the KGB had found it. They were waiting for him to come back and try to pick it up. It could have been, you know, anything, but it turned out to be that Angleton was, you know, still so much believing that Polyakov was a plant and a provocation, instructed the CIA Moscow station not to pick it up because he feared it was fake. And in the meantime, Ed Moody, his stalwart FBI supporter, because he felt very close to Polyakov and believed in him, in memos that he shared with me during, you know, all of our sourcing, just showed how he was kind of was pleading with the CIA to say, come on, this guy is real, you know, don't do this to him. And eventually they do pick up the drop 8 weeks later, and then they run an ad to tell him that they picked it up, but they couldn't help themselves by saying, hey, but you never picked up the present at Betty, which of course with the signal site basically saying you didn't leave a message that you had left a drop, which Moody doesn't think was true. So, you know, there were a lot of little battles going right on here, you know, and of course Polyakov didn't think, you know, Polyakov knew he had. And so, you know, I think it was difficult between the, it's sort of like the turf wars of today, you know, there's, you have the turf wars and they get messed up because people have different agendas.
It does say a lot for Polyakov that he stuck it out, because there was so much going against him doing this. How frustrating it must have been for him to watch all the, you know, infighting within the United States and them kind of treating him, you know, certainly from the CIA perspective, as a fake agent in the, you know, kind of the Keystone Cops FBI, where they're pretending there wasn't a signal, and of course there was, and later on, they do what he says not to do, and they try to hunt him down. A lot of these things would have made a lesser man just walk away.
Absolutely, absolutely. I think that's why he was so extraordinary. You know, he, like you said, there were just so many things. Even when they were arresting the illegals, finally, a couple of years after he had returned to Moscow, giving him enough time so that he wouldn't look suspicious with the illegals that were being arrested. But Carlo Tuomi, who had been the Finnish illegal that he trained and was one of their most high-profile illegals, who had also been turned, gave up Polyakov's name, and it appears in the New York Times, you know, as an agent. And, you know, he did. He had to bear a lot, and still he stuck it through. And part of what I think was extraordinary about him is that, you know, we'll probably talk about some of this later as well, but there were so many times when things were going against him. You know, the Americans didn't actually believe in him. The Americans print his name in the newspaper. Later on, there are some breaches to his security in the American press. And yet the Soviets continue to have complete faith in him. So he had an extraordinary personality in that he was able to engender trust, you know, despite all these things that would have felled a lesser man, for sure.
Right. Well, I want to leave some for the reader, but I want to skip ahead to New Delhi, because I think this is where kind of the two families come together and the two stories really intersect. He goes, you know, lots of different, your father goes from Mexico City to other places. Polyakov goes to Burma, back to Moscow. But eventually everybody, and I say everybody, the Dillon family and the Polyakov family, are sent to New Delhi, India. When Polyakov is promoted to Major General, which means he has ridiculous amounts of secrets available
Absolutely.
To him. He's at the very highest level. You and your family are there as well. And essentially, your father was sent in with the singular job of running Polyakov for CIA.
Yes. And that was a very unusual post for a case officer. Normally you'd come in and be trying to run many, but Poyakov was so prolific, and his information was so valuable that, you know, they wanted to send in one person who could really focus on it. And it's also, I think, interesting to note that the handlers who had handled him up until the time that my father did were controlled by Angleton. He was able to choose who those handlers would be, and when they came to work with him, they were all black hats. They were all actually against the idea of what he was trying to do because they didn't believe in it. My father was the first handler sent to work with Poyakov who was not a black hat. My father was really kind of an extraordinary man, and they developed a very trusting friendship relationship. You know, the most important thing between an asset and a handler is trust.
Right.
And my father engendered trust in everyone he knew because he saw the dignity in all people, and people felt that from him. You know, he attended a Jesuit high school and Jesuit Boston College, where he studied philosophy and theology and Greek and Latin. He had a great love of languages, which is why he took up Russian so easily. And he was influenced, I think, by the Jesuits' free thinking education platform, which opened his mind to peoples of all types and cultures. And his character building in him was also part of the Jesuits' vow of poverty, which can be interpreted as a poverty of self, that you were not better than any other person. You know, he trusted you and you trusted him. Everybody felt that. His assets trusted him. Poyakov trusted him. And as a response to that, because of my father's nature, the level of the reporting after he got there was just, you know, some of the most incredible reporting that they got out of him. You know, it was the pinnacle of, you know, this great relationship and the fact that he was a general. You know, the intelligence was astonishing in its importance and details. You know, by dint of Poyakov's rank, his years of service, his war heroism, he was now a member of the GRU's elite inner circle. He had access to the highest level of Soviet war planning and strategy and military philosophy. And as a senior party activist, he was trusted with the secret Ministry of Foreign Affairs material and party directives. You know, he was a member of the old boy network by now, with access to critical state secrets.
Well, one of these was the journal Military Thought, which was, there was a declassified version, but he had access to the super classified version, which told the Americans kind of the inner thinking of the Soviet high command, everything from their assessment of nuclear war to the impact, and this is my field, the impact of the spying on technology, the fact that something you say in the book, like 5,000 programs within the Soviet Union used Western technology that had been stolen during the Cold War.
Oh, it was amazing. It was, and that was another one of Poyakov's great contributions, was opening up, you know, informing the Americans how much of their military technology was being stolen. You know, these orders were issued annually by the Soviet Military Industrial Commission, and they were very, very good at it. And American analysts at the times were startled by the quantity and the knowledge of classified American systems. And so as a result of Poyakov, you know, informing the Americans on how much was actually being stolen, they closely sealed up a lot of the information on Western military technology so it couldn't be stolen anymore. It was really incredible. And, you know, I think, you know, as you said, he offered Military Thought and all kinds of important documents. And by reading all the super secret documents that Poyakov slipped to the Americans, U.S. military experts came to understand that Russians' assessment of nuclear war was not much different from their own. Poyakov's intelligence showed that Soviet military leaders were as worried as their American counterparts were, that they were not, in fact, crazy warmongers.
Well, and that was the perception before that, right? They're going to fight a war and win a war, and now everyone is just as worried about this.
Exactly. They really did believe that the Soviets, you know, would and were ready and, you know, could at any moment use those weapons. And Poyakov comes in and says, no, not really. They're quite scared. And it completely changed the whole paradigm and diffused tensions. And it made it so that the Kremlin could not substantially threaten America and her allies because, you know, the Americans knew the truth behind it,
right.
You know. And it really did help diffuse tensions.
What I thought was fantastic and was a really fun part of the book was how your father and Polyakov were able to communicate out in the open, how they were able to spend a lot of time with each other right under the watchful eye of the KGB and the GRU. Go ahead. No, it's just a great story. It's just a wonderful way of doing.
Well, it's because, you know, and I think this was probably a tool used on occasion with other assets and handlers, but the CIA set up this useful ruse by, quote-unquote, allowing Polyakov to recruit my father as a developmental contact. And so Polyakov, you know, reported to Moscow that he was attempting to engage an American embassy official whom he'd met at a number of diplomatic functions, and they both enjoyed hunting and fishing. And the center was encouraged and gave my father a code name, Plaid. I couldn't believe my father had a code name, which was Plaid. And as a result of this, because, you know, they had given Polyakov permission to recruit my father, they could meet relatively out in the open. They would, you know, go out to the Yamuna River and fishing and hunting, and we kids laugh because we're pretty sure that Dad never once shot a rifle. You know, he was not a hunter. You know, his quarry was information. but as a result, you know, they were able to meet out in the open. And one evening, I was already back in college at this time, so this story comes through my brothers in India, and my mother says to them, you know, tonight a very important Russian diplomat is coming over to visit with Dad, and they're going to be talking about hunting and fishing, and they're going to go into the den, so please don't disturb them. But of course my brothers were all curious, and they came down to the foyer when he came in, and there was standing a Russian general in his full uniform with his big military hat, and we laugh because he's kind of smiling as he looks down at our 1970s, you know, my brothers with their long hair and their tie-dye t-shirts and everything, and he gives them each a piece of candy, and they go into the den and they lock the door, and my brother says, wow, a Russian general, you don't see one of those every day.
Well, that, yeah. And that actually works out for a while, but unfortunately your father gets outed when you're in New Delhi. This is a time when many, many, many CIA officers get outed, all because of one disgruntled former employee decides to write a book.
Yes, I was 17, and it was the summer of 1975, and I was 17, and a newspaper article, you know, identified my father as a CIA officer. And, you know, my six brothers and sisters had always been told that he was a State Department employee, and that article from the Times of India, which is the American, the English-speaking paper from there, basically was reporting on the newly published book, which would probably be familiar to many of your podcast listeners, Inside the Company CIA Diary, by the former CIA case officer Philip Agee, in which he outed hundreds of CIA operations around the world and 250 identities of covert officers around the world, including my father's, for whom he had worked in Mexico 7 years earlier. And that is how we found out that my father was in the CIA. You know, we had always thought he was a Foreign Service officer, and that was our big reveal.
And there's scuttlebutt that your dad may have fired Agee from Mexico City, or do you think he just resigned and wanted to move on with his life?
Well, in Agee's book, he says he resigned and wanted to get out of there. But, you know, when you go around and talk to all the people from those times, a lot of them say, nah, that's not what happened. He was problematic. He had issues. He was kind of a troublemaker. You know, what the truth is, and somebody said your dad fired him. But the truth is, who knows? You know, because so many of these guys are gone, and I think, you know, in any office, you want to put your best face forward. So I don't know which the truth is, but I kind of believe he was fired just because of, you know, how many people told me that he was kind of a troublemaker.
Well, regardless of why he left, because of your father being outed, he couldn't meet on a day-to-day basis with Polyakov anymore. It's had to go somewhat underground. And this is when an interesting communication technology comes into play, for the very first time, and you highlight it in your book, and this is the unique system.
Yes, yes. Oh, the unique was amazing. You know, Polyakov was going to be returning to Moscow from Delhi in 1976, and of course, when you're in Moscow, it's KGB infested. You know, using the regular dead drops is just dangerous. And because Polyakov was the highest-ranking Soviet intelligence officer in the history of the U.S. government, you know, the Langley team felt obligated to find a more secure way of communicating than the risky dead drop systems they'd used for years. So they went to the Langley support team and made a request to their technical support component. They wanted something very revolutionary, a short-range, high-speed, two-way communications device that encrypted and transmitted information and was small enough to fit in a pocket. But the agency's Office of Technical Service balked. You know, they were pointing out that there had never been any technology like it. It didn't exist. You remember, it's 1974. It would be 20 years before instant text messaging devices could be, you know, were introduced to the public. But undeterred, the Langley team enlisted the help of an outside scientific contractor and working against the clock. They had 2 years before Polyakov would be returning to Moscow. They produced a prototype, a transceiver that had no precedent in either the espionage or civilian worlds. And it was suitably codenamed Unique. There was nothing like it out there. And some compared it to the technical leap equivalent to the telephone in public communications. But Unique was developed specifically for Polyakov and was a stunning breakthrough in communication technology. It was a transmitter and a receiver. It was a two-way system small enough to fit in a pocket. It had a tiny Cyrillic script keyboard that, you know, you'd enter information in with a stylus. And it automatically encrypted messages, and then sending radios was about 1,000 feet, and it transmitted messages in bursts of 2.6 seconds. And some people say it was possibly the world's first text message exchanges. And Polyakov was blown away. For one of the first times, he was always a technology person who sometimes would criticize America's fancy gear, like it was so fancy it wouldn't work. He sometimes preferred his own basic gear. But when he got Unique, he said, this is impressive, and he loved it.
Did I mention that Mother's Day is this weekend? Sherry's Berries is offering huge, freshly dipped strawberries starting at just $19.99 plus shipping. And right now you can double the berries for just $10 more. Pick your delivery date, and these berries are guaranteed to arrive fresh and delicious, or your money back. Let's talk bottom line. You may think you've seen gourmet dipped strawberries before, but you've never seen anything like these. And look, this is the copy, but I'm not messing with you guys. I've ordered dipped strawberries before, but we're talking ridiculously sized strawberries. Sherry's Berries are huge, sweet, juicy, and covered in decadent toppings. Chocolate chips, chopped nuts, white milk, and dark chocolatey goodness. Sherry's Berries are the unexpected gift that will put a smile on any mom's face. You can surprise your mom with Sherry's Berries at her office or workplace, but I wouldn't advise it. Send it to her house. Send it specially made to where no one else can touch it. They sent Sherry's Berries here to the office. I ate one berry. It was just mauled by everybody else in the office. I'd love to tell you how good all their flavors were, but I had to order a second set just to try the different stuff. The original one, I only got one stinking berry out of. It was the size of a softball, but it was a really, really good berry. So send it to her house. Don't make mom have to punch out her coworkers to keep her Sherry's Berries. Now, the only way to get this amazing berries deal starting at $19.99 is to visit berries.com. Click on the microphone in the top right corner and use our code SPYCAST. That's BERRIES.com and code SPYCAST when you click on the mic. This amazing deal won't last long, and Mother's Day is this weekend. So be sure to order now. Click on the microphone in the top right corner at berries.com and use our code SPYCAST. So I want to wrap up the Polyakov story in a second, but I want to take a quick little tangent because there's a really fun story. I mean, fun because me, I'm a kind of a tech nerd, and I'm also an airplane nerd. So there's a great little aside here about another relatively famous spy, a Soviet Air Force officer this time, who kind of appeared in your life a little bit, although you thought he was Victor Schmidt and he was East German, he was really somebody entirely different. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. Yeah. All right. I think a lot of people remember in 1976 when a Soviet pilot defected from Siberia with the super-secret MiG-25 Foxback jet, flying under radar across the Sea of Japan and landed on the northern Japanese island of Hokkaido. And the Soviet MiG-25 Foxback was considered to be the most advanced fighter jet in the world. No Westerner had ever seen the legendary technology and mechanics of the super-secret jet, which flew faster than any American planes could. And it had been clocked at Mach 3.2 during the Yom Kippur War. It was like this mystery plane that everybody was in awe of. Western analysis of the people, but once they did have the, so many lands, and everybody was like, oh my God, it's a MiG-25, you know, and Western analysts and mechanics started taking it apart and showed that, though, that the MiG-25 was actually only a short-range, high-speed interceptor with limited maneuverability, incapable of air-to-air combat. So basically, it could fly high and fast, and that was it.
And straight.
As a result,
yeah,
America's Air Force reoriented the allocation of major segments of their military funding because they thought they were having to develop a whole new, area of jet technology when, in fact, they didn't. So that was amazing that he defected and brought the plane, but it was more amazing what they found out about that plane. And then the fun part of that story is that Dad becomes his handler, and this is when we were back living in the United States, and you know, all of a sudden Dad would often bring home foreigners, you know, from work, for you know, he was in the Foreign Service, that's what we thought, and that's why he brought the people back. But Victor was a little different because he was younger and he was handsome and he was funny and he didn't speak very good English. And our parents told us that his name was Victor Schmidt when in fact his name was Victor Belenko, and that he was East German because he could speak some passable German. And Dad was his handler overseeing his months-long debriefings, but he was also tasked with helping him to assimilate into American culture. And he hung around our Washington, D.C. suburban house a lot, and was funny about what he knew and what he didn't know, like he thought the toilet brush was to wash his back, you know. And then when we found out, we were all laughing, and he was funny. And it was difficult for him to assimilate into American culture, as it is for most, most Soviet defectors. They don't know what they're going to find here. Like when Dad took him to a grocery store, he wouldn't believe it. You know, he was used to lines out the door and bins that had like one rotten cabbage in it, as opposed to an American grocery store that was just overflowing in abundance. And he made my father drive him around to five other grocery stores before he started to believe that this is really what you have, you know, in America. And but then at one point he had to face what all defectors have to face, which is the point when, you know, his debriefers have gotten all the information out of them that they have, and they don't have any more questions. And you were a hero. Your ego being stroked every single day. We need you. What else can you tell us? You're so wonderful. Oh, your information's so great. And then one day that's over, and you really do have to figure out a life for yourself. And one of the stories that I like from that part of my book is when he decides to go down to Florida to enroll in an intense English language course, and he meets a young South American woman, and they, you know, their relationship blooms into a full love affair. But you know, she can't stay in the United States; she has to return to her country, and it was just too much for him to, you know, take up his stakes and move to another country as well. So they parted ways, and it triggered. It was like a breaking point for him. It triggered this, homesickness in him, and all of a sudden he kind of went crazy. He told me, because I had a meeting, you know, I did meet with him. We had a wonderful reunion and met, and he told me the story, and it was just he freaked out, and he just felt sad and alone and, you know, not connected. And he said he was going to go up to the Soviet embassy and say, guess what, I do want to come home to my motherland. And he drove all the way up to the D.C. area, but he had one stop to make before he got to the Soviet embassy, which was at my father's house. And he's banging on the door in the middle of the night at 4 a.m., and he comes downstairs, and my brothers come downstairs, and my father sends my brothers back upstairs and brings him inside. And basically talks him down and says, you cannot go to the Soviet embassy. Yes, you feel, you know, you feel homesick right now. You don't think you'll ever fit in, but you will. But you cannot go to the embassy. And one of the things that Victor said to me when we met, and he was so emotional, he said, your father saved my life. He says, I was crazy. I was out of my mind, and your father saved my life. And he often told me that he thought my father was his father because, you know, he had a largely absent father. And my father was just, you know, the perfect person for someone like him who was trying to, you know, assimilate into the country. And eventually my father died. And a couple years later, my mother got a birth announcement, and they had named their new baby. He got married to an American woman, and they'd named their new baby Paul after my father, which was very touching to all of us.
My favorite part of that story you didn't mention was that you're a teenager at this time and you've got a bunch of sisters. And Victor, being a young hotshot fighter pilot, perhaps took to one of your sisters more than others. And how your father's reaction to that was pretty funny.
Well, he was cute. He was 28. The rest of us were in our early 20s. He was 28. He was, you know, muscly. He was funny. I think we all kind of had crushes on him. I certainly did. But he started flirting with my oldest sister, Maria, and it did not take long before my father made sure to shut that down. I think the last thing he wanted was for my sister to fall in love with a Soviet defector who still had the danger of possible kidnapping, you know, and other things that could happen to him as part of his life. And I'm sure he also took Victor aside and said, no way.
Well, another fun part of this. Yeah, sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, that didn't last so long. Yes.
Another fun part of the story is the Soviets would eventually get their plane back, not necessarily how they expected to.
No. In fact, what happened is of course, they wanted to analyze every detail about the plane. And so they, you know, it stayed in Japan, and they took it apart piece by piece and fully analyzed the whole thing. And the Soviets were demanding their plane back, and, you know, they were buzzing the Japanese fishing boats and, you know, making trouble, you know, with their diplomats. And finally, 8 weeks later, they did get their plane back, but in pieces. They were delivered to the port in Japan and put onto a Soviet ship in 5 great big huge containers with all the pieces, and that's how they got their plane back.
A nice little sense of humor there for that.
Yes.
So let's look at the end of this story a little bit. I think there's some key issues here. I was surprised to see, and I actually didn't know a lot about this before, I was surprised to see how much Angleton's team, talk about the Black Hats, talk about the people that Angleton had groomed under him, could have potentially led to at least the initial suspicion that Polyakov was spying for the United States.
Yes. In fact, it was really an unfortunate thing how they were all very dedicated to Angleton, and they, you know, even after he was fired, they wanted, you know, Angleton just did not believe that Polyakov was not, you know, bona fide, that he wasn't the real thing. And so Angleton was fired in 1974 by Bill Colby and became an embittered man. And he, you know, and yet he found ways to continue to try to out those he still believed were provocations. And one of those ways were through journalists in the press. Edward J. Epstein had recently published a book. He was a journalist who had recently published a book about Lee Harvey Oswald and Kennedy called Legend. And during the course of his research, he found out the name of a Soviet asset in the UN mission in the 60s who was codenamed Fedora. And in that article, and that information was then showed up in an article in New York Magazine because he was promoting his book. And he wrote about the fact that in the 1960s, the FBI had an asset named Fedora, and then he said, and 2 other Soviets, which were in quotes, who joined Fedora in supplying the FBI with information. Then, in a subsequent New York Times item, he revealed Polyakov's FBI code name Top Hat. Not that it was Polyakov, but just his code name Top Hat. It was widely believed that Angleton was the one who did this, because nobody would have done it without his permission, right? This started the KGB on a hunt for Fedora and Top Hat. They didn't know who they were behind the code names, but they knew where they'd been, that they're part of the UN mission, the era, that sort of thing.
This is the part of the story where two infamous Americans come into play, and one of them could have ended Polyakov's operation long before it eventually does, and that's Robert Hansen, who is the FBI agent turned traitor, who actually told the GRU about him long, long, long before he was finally arrested for doing what he was doing.
Well, yeah, after these breaches come out by, Epstein, so that's bad enough, right? So here are these breaches with his codename and everything. And then in early 1979 in New York City, Robert Hansen walks into the Broadway office of Amtorg, which is the Soviet trading organization he knows serves as a front for the GRU, and for money offered up Polyakov's identity as a spy for the United States. Now, Polyakov doesn't know this, and the GRU doesn't want to know it. They don't want to believe it. They did not want to repeat this information to their KGB rivals, as it would make them look bad, and eventually Polyakov, it would make them look bad, and they wanted to sweep it all under the rug. They just could not believe that a decorated war hero general would, spy against his own country. And instead, they kind of suspected Robert Hansen of being a provocation, coming in to try to make trouble. But they couldn't be sure, right? But then now you have a combination of the fedora, the top hat problem, and then also David Martin in 1980, when Polyakov is still back in Delhi in his second tour, writes the book Wilderness of Mirrors, and he's sort of picking up where Epstein left off and gives out the code names, the CIA cryptonyms, Scotch and Bourbon. Scotch was for Alexei Kukulak, and Bourbon was for Polyakov. Now they have too many pieces of the puzzle.
Right.
The ramparts of this cover are crumbling, and they just have too many pieces of the puzzle. So they, call him back. Now the KGB does, ostensibly for a meeting of Southeast Asia residentura chiefs, but really to try to get them back, so that they could analyze and keep them there. And they gave them all medical exams and told Polyakov that he was unfit, his health was unfit for going back to India. So he started figuring out that he was under suspicion. But
And then you get Alder Games, and the complete bottom falls out.
Yeah, well, see, what happens is that they decide to just go ahead and sweep all these issues that are going on with Polyakov under the rug, and they let him retire, and he's retired for 5 years, living happily out at his dacha with his granddaughter and, in hunting and doing his woodworking and everything, and then Aldrich Ames comes along, and Aldrich Ames did it for money, He gets this job and, had access to this information and had met a very pretty young Colombian cultural attaché when they were both in Mexico. And they, they get married, and she spends a lot of money and wants a fancier lifestyle, and he gets more and more in debt. And finally, he's just, this is his option. He decides to give information over to the KGB, and he sets up a lunch date with Sergei Chubakin, who's actually an arms specialist, who avoided him for months. But eventually, in April 85, they set up a lunch date, and when Chubakin didn't show up, Ames, who had been drinking vodka, he was nervous and he got very drunk, decided to walk to the Soviet embassy and leave a note for the head of the resident Residentura and letting him know that he knew who his code name was and that he wanted $50,000 in order to give up information about some spies he knew about. And they gave him the $50,000. And after that, Ames decided to impress them even more and walked out of the CIA in June of 1985 with a huge bag of information. They hadn't even asked for any, which included all of the names of every Soviet asset he knew in every operation, and the CIA dubbed it the Big Dump because it was just so much information, and it included Polyakov's identity. And that was really the beginning of the end for Polyakov.
And one name we haven't mentioned that kind of wraps this up somewhat nicely is someone that worked on the Polyakov case with your father, someone we actually know here very well at the Spy Museum, Sandy Grimes, who is one of the most extraordinary officers in CIA history. She was very intimately involved with the Polyakov case, was devastated when he was wrapped up and executed or he disappeared, but got a little bit of satisfaction from being also intimately involved in sending Aldrich Ames to prison for the rest of his life.
Absolutely. You know, the thing about Sandy is she actually was the longest serving case officer on the Polyakov case, you know, from when she first started in 1971 all the way through to 1980 when he kind of disappeared from the scene. And she just had a dedication to him that was just unusual and very beautiful, and would always wanted to protect him. And there was an instance where a new head of a Soviet division wanted to come in and make Polyakov. Polyakov had gone under again in Moscow, and he had come in and said, "We must make contact with him." And Sandy was like, "He has asked us not to, and it's way too dangerous." And the new head of the division said, "You must do it, you must do it." And it kind of turned into a fiasco. And it was Sandy who kept trying to protect Polyakov. And eventually, when it became clear that there was a mole in the agency, she was about to retire, and somebody came to her and said, "Would you join Jean Vertefe's team?" And she said, "You've just made me the only offer I could not, to turn away," and because she was so dedicated, for the welfare of Polyakov. And she was put her nose to the grindstone, analyzed all the evidence, and was the one who eventually actually put two and two together to show the proof of the money coming into Aldrich Ames's accounts and his meetings with Sergei Chuvakin when he would go and, give all of this information. She's the one who put the two together and said, "Rick is a goddamn Soviet spy." and it went, and it went from there. That's when they were really able to launch the FBI investigation, and they finally caught him. But it was really couldn't have been done without Sandy, who was very, very dedicated to the case.
We'd like to thank our friends at Harry's, Bloom That, and Sherry's Berries. Remember, you can get your free trial set, including a razor handle, 5-blade cartridge, and shave gel by going to harrys.com/spycast. You can get a free premium design bouquet, free vase, and treats by going to bloomthat.com/spycast, and freshly dipped strawberries starting at just $19.99 plus shipping, or you can double the berries for just $10 more. Go to berries.com, use the code SPYCAST when you click on the mic at the top right corner. So We've left out a ton of stuff. I didn't want to give the listener the entire book. There's so much more in this book worth looking at. The book is called Spies in the Family, An American Spy Master, His Russian Crown Jewel, and the Friendship That Helped End the Cold War. The author is Eva Dillon. Thank you so much, Eva, for taking the time to talk to us here on SpyCast.
Thank you, Vince.
Thank you for joining us on SpyCast. Every Tuesday, we'll give you the most interesting conversations with some of the most intriguing people in the world of intelligence. If you'd like to send us a comment or suggestion, you can email us at spycast@spymuseum.org. That's spycast@spymuseum.org. Or tweet us at @intlspycast. That's intlspycast. The International Spy Museum is a full 501c3 nonprofit institution. To help support future educational programming, please visit spymuseum.org. And click on our Donate Now link at the top of the page. Thank you, and we'll see you next week.